This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1004, A Conversation with Ron Friends. Welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1004, A Conversation with Ron Friends. Ron Friends has been, for a long time, one of my favorite artists and storytellers, but also just a great guy and a great guest to have on a podcast. I've been extremely privileged to have him on 10 previous episodes. The last time he was on, it was episode 1000, which was, the last episode for a while. Now he's back. So I'm very excited to have Ron back on. It's always a pleasure to talk to him about his craft, the book, the work that's been published and come out since our last conversation. He's just a great guy, has some great remembrances here. We talk about John Romita Sr., who obviously recently passed away. So Ron is, remains one of my favorite human beings. He's just such a nice, guy who is so giving of his time and is such a talented illustrator and storyteller, and I continue to be just marveled by everything he does on the page. He's just an exquisite storyteller and artist, and it's always a pleasure to have him on the show. I just realized that I didn't even really intro the show at all. This is the Comic Shenanigans podcast. I am your host, Adam Chapman. This is the 11th time that Ron Friends has been on the show, and hopefully not the last, because he's such a, as I said, just a great guy. So thank you once again for downloading this episode. You can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes, and thanks so much for downloading the show. Without further ado, let's jump right into the conversation as I sit down with Ron Friends to talk about many things, but particularly to talk about John Romita Sr. and also his recent work, revisiting A-Next in a Marvel Infinity comic with Tom DeFalco. Enjoy. Ron, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Adam, and welcome back to you. The interwebs have missed you, so it's wonderful to hear your dulcet, somewhat Paul Rudd-sounding voice once more resonating across the internet. So welcome back to you, my friend.
Well, that's very kind. Well, I knew that, if I'm going to come back and do a podcast again, I definitely have to have you on one of the first few episodes because you're always such a great friend of the show, and you had done, I think, 10 appearances before, so it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Actually, in between the last time you were on the show and when I ended the podcast, and now we actually got to meet each other in person, which was really nice. So I just want to thank you for your continued friendship and also just for your great artwork that I'm still continuing to thrill at.
Well, you humble me, and I thank you very much. And just for your viewers, as much as he sounds like Paul Rudd, at least to me, he doesn't really look like Paul Rudd, although he is very handsome in his own way.
Oh, that's very kind. So in the past year, I have to talk about the fact that we finally got to have a reunion of sorts with you and Tom, the legendary Tom DeFalco, doing an A-Next story for the Marvel Infinity app. I was so excited when I heard about it. I couldn't wait to read it. It did not disappoint. It was, I think, issues, 37 and 38 of the Avengers Unlimited Infinity comic. Can you tell me how it came about? Because it was such a thrill for fans of A-Next, which there are more than just me, I promise.
One would hope, but we were approached. I guess they had recently done a Spider-Girl that we weren't involved with at all. And I guess there was some positive response to it for them to further pursue the MC2 brand. Mm-hmm. And we were contacted about doing an A-Next one. And, DeFalco was intrigued because it was, basically like 30 panels, although I did insert panels along the way and stuff. But he was intrigued about it and didn't quite understand exactly how it worked, but he didn't really have to. Mm-hmm. So he broke it down pretty much in the normal way as 30 panels, and ad libbed a little along the way there, but we did it the way we always do it. I mean, he said, you know, you got any ideas? And I said, well, I always wondered if we went back to AMAX, there was always this editorial note at the end of the first issue where they talked about a feast in Asgard in celebration of AMAX being there and, you know, Kevin and Thor and all that. And you promised that we'll tell you all about it sometime. And we never did because we only had a year to play with. I said, so what if we do that? And, you know, so we can kind of do a flashback to the original gang. We can, you know, flashback to the, how they got together. And then we can move it into present day. And we've always enjoyed the troll characters. So, you know, it seemed, you know, it flowed fairly naturally from there. And we had a lot of fun with it. I mean, I always love returning to Asgard. Reacquainting myself with those characters was a lot of fun. Brett Breeding was available to ink it. Mm-hmm. It really was kind of like putting on a pair of comfortable shoes and walking another mile or so with the old team. I loved doing the characters again. And we also, we got to do the original guys from the first issue with like Speedball and Jubilee and Jolt. But then we also flashed forward and got to do Saberclaw and Blue Streak and all that. So it was really a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Now, I'm curious about the mechanics of it, because obviously, like, you still use the boards, right? Like, you haven't gone digital, as far as I know, correct?
Yes. Brett Breeding came up with some templates for me with the size of the, you know, the proportion of the phone 1.5 times up. So I was basically doing them as, you know, separate panels. There were a couple of runs, they call it, where you have the option of trying to do something more clever with the storytelling. And I tried it once or twice. We were sent one example by a young illustrator, I'm not even sure who it was, who really used the scrolling to a wonderful effect. Just, you know, using it like a camera move in a movie, and it was really, really effective. And I tried that once or twice, but mostly I was using occasional insert panels as runs to necessitate some of the smaller actions in the course of it and stuff. Mm-hmm. But overall, it was a lot of fun. I mean, I don't have an iPhone, so I was sent a PDF, so I was able to see it in the scrolling of a PDF. Mm-hmm. And Brett put a lot of extra work into color notes and things like that to make sure everybody was colored correctly and stuff. He was more than willing to do that. I get exhausted after the first round, but Brett is very detail oriented, being the inker that he is and the professional that he is. Mm-hmm. So he was able to pursue it a little bit more and make sure that everything was even colored right. So it was, you know, I was very, very proud of the finished product. So
I was really impressed with Chris Sotomayor's colors because, I mean, obviously he's been around a long time and, you know, he's done a lot of what I would call quote-unquote kind of classic-looking books that I, when I first started kind of noticing his name a lot in the mid-2000s. So the colors on the book just felt, on the issues, felt very in tone with the way the book had always been colored. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't feel like it was using too much of the kind of quote-unquote modern coloring techniques. Obviously they are present, but it did feel very naturally kind of old school four color, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I thought he did a wonderful job. I don't like it when people try too hard to match what they perceive to be the coloring of the time. Because with the new printing and everything, sometimes the color can become too dense or too flat or both, and, you know, I really don't intend for colorists to try to enhance, you know, I mean, I've never worked with, if somebody were actually willing to do that wonderful thing that they do where they make it look a little aged or they can recreate the effect of Ben-Day dots or something, mm-hmm. if somebody could do that, for a particular flashback or something. That would be really cool. But, I mean, even when we were doing A-Next in the 90s, at the end of the 90s, it really wasn't that anymore anyway, and it wasn't Flex. You know, it was relatively modern coloring with just a little less modeling than we have now. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that he didn't try too hard, you know. But he did a really nice, dynamic, bright, rich coloring job on it. And I very much liked it. Yeah, very much liked it.
Now, when we
I don't know if I should even say this. I don't know if I should say this while we're recording. As I'm talking about the job, I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
You don't have it in front of you, do you?
Of course I do.
You do? You have it in front of you right now?
I have it in front of me at this exact moment, yes.
I think I made an error that nobody caught.
Really?
In the flashbacks, okay, is J2 wearing his dad's shirt, or did I just put him in the shorts that he wears later?
No, he is wearing the shirt around his waist.
He is?
In the flashbacks, he is.
Really? Okay. I'm smarter than I thought I was. Okay.
Actually, it's funny you mentioned it, because I had forgotten that he had switched to pants at some point, so I was just looking at the kind of the framing sequence, and I was like, oh yeah, he switched to pants, and then I checked later on, and then, yeah, he's still wearing the shirt, so you didn't make a mistake.
As we were talking about it, I'm thinking, I might have screwed that up, because all I remember drawing was him in the pants. Yeah, he started wearing the pants when he gave his dad the shirt back.
Oh, that's right.
Tom made a scene of it in J2, where he finally reunites with his dad and returns his shirt to him. And so I had to come up with something else to keep him kind of casual. And apparently, his modesty prevents him from walking around in just tights. So I came up with the baggies. But I'm glad. Okay. Wow. I was going to go check as soon as we got off and find out. But thank you for reassuring me.
No. Yeah, not to worry. Now, I have a question, because you mentioned how Tom kind of went about plotting the panels. When we had originally done kind of our deconstruction of the first 12 issues of A-Next, you kind of remarked that you did a lot more of the plotting in that because Tom had been pulled in a lot of different directions when the MC2 was kind of taking off, or with all right. the different titles. And so you had a lot heavier of a hand than maybe typically you would have had in the past with regards to the plotting. Did that carry over at all to working on A-Next again here, or was it more back to the more traditional kind of plot first and then Marvel method that you guys traditionally use?
Well, aside from the initial idea being mine, I pitched the initial idea. Mm-hmm. Tom built on that, and we worked pretty much the way we always did on Spider-Girl, because as he put together the plot to break it down for 30 panels, he felt that was the best way to approach it, and I agreed. And but you know, there was like some bits that I came up with on the fly, and as always, I called Tom and pitched it to him first before I pursued it. In this case, it was the Kevin's solution and Cassie's suggestion to overload the battery. As Tyrus is trying to is absorbing the Uru energy that is within Kevin that feeds his power, and we needed something that showed some teamwork, you know. Mm-hmm. So Cassie, being the scientist, she suggested overloading the battery and just pouring it on. Have Kevin, instead of fighting it, have him pour it on and overload the battery, which indeed worked. And then also explains why Tyrus is wearing an eye patch when he shows up in the future in the Dargo comic we did, 30 years ago or whatever it was.
That's right, yeah.
Because I wanted to cover that, because when we did him at A-Next, he didn't have the patch. So I said, oh, this would be an opportunity to have him wounded and explain the eye patch. So, it all falls together sometimes, you know. One of the silly things that I had fun with in this is Tom came up with the idea of Urok's grandma.
Yeah.
and I was searching for a visual for her, and a few times in the past, I know Buscema did, I think Kirby did briefly, they showed female trolls. But what it occurred to me is is for all the trolls that have been through all the years of Marvel Comics and everything, the Asgardian trolls, we never did anything that kind of tied into the old troll dolls from the 60s. And I said that might be something to hang an idea on. So I gave Grandma the hair of the old troll dolls and gave her the build of the old troll dolls. And she looked like an old shriveled troll doll. And most people don't even know what those are anymore. There was a young friend of mine from Australia who I correspond with on Facebook, private message, and he had heard me say in an interview that there was one thing I did before it had come out. There was one thing I did I was kind of proud of, and that nobody had ever thought of before. And when he saw the strip, he didn't really understand what it was. And I explained it to him, and he still didn't understand what it was. So I had to pull a picture of an old troll doll off the internet and send him a JPEG. And then he went, "Oh, okay." So he, you know, the younger guys aren't going to get it. What can I tell you?
That's funny. I guess that's true. I hadn't really thought of that. So, changing the tone a little bit, this is a bit more somber, but one thing I did want to talk to you about is obviously we recently lost John Romita Sr. And I obviously, you had the chance to work with him. He inked you. Is it just the once, or did he ink you again?
Well, there were a few opportunities. He inked interior pages of that annual.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what you're thinking.
That's what I'm thinking of. So that's the Amazing Spider-Man 96 annual.
Exactly. He inked me on a cover, the Manslaughter Marsdale cover. He inked that just, I guess, on a whim or something. It's not signed, but it was inked by John Romita Sr. And the one thing I did an essay about on my Facebook page was the incredible moment when Mr. Romita was working on the Marvel merchandising book, basically the pamphlet that they put together for potential people who want to license merchandise, Marvel merchandise. Mm-hmm. So Marvel puts together a book that shows character shots and turnarounds and color guides and things like that. And of course, he was art editor at the time, so he's a very, very busy man and had many, many duties. But as they were putting this thing together, I got a phone call at one point where I was told that Mr. Romita said, "I don't have the time to do all of this. I tell you what, call Ron Friends and I'll ink it." So it was an amazing pat on the back for me.
Mm-hmm.
That he was aware enough of my work and was aware enough of my ties to classic Marvel and everything, that he felt I could handle it to the degree that, you know, it would be, you know, it would be done right, and he would be able to ink it, and we would be able to complete the merchandise guide in a timely manner. So I did several. So a lot of it was stuff that was pulled from existing artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, I was very flattered and humbled that they used some of my stuff for that. But then they also, when they approached me to actually do new stuff like Captain America surfing on a shield, the Hulk playing drums, you know, those kinds of crazy things, Spider-Man on a BMX bike, Spider-Man on a skateboard, you know, things like that, I was able to, you know, I was doing the drawing. I was dealing with the blank page, and then Mr. Romita inked it and in his usual inimitable style, and it was an amazing nod to me that I was doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a couple other interactions like that. My rep at one point, when I was with John Romita and his wonderful wife, Virginia, at one point, I believe it was a Chicago con, years and years and years ago, I had the opportunity to stand and watch him do quick sketches for the fan.
Mm-hmm.
And just amazing stuff. And at that point, for some reason that I'll never understand, it was, I guess, the mid-80s, he's working on, he does a sketch of Mary Jane, and none of these idiot kids standing at the table wanted it. He was doing free sketches.
What?
And yeah, I know. I mean, we're talking about this weird time when the superstars were superstarring, and guys like Romita and Buscemi, you know, were falling between the cracks. You know, we're talking about the very beginnings of the image crap, and the idea that, you know, I remember hearing about kids at a comic shop when Buscemi, John Buscemi, did the Wolverine Bloody Choices graphic novel,
mm-hmm.
that they were sitting there looking at it going, but it's so, I mean, it's all in panels, and it's not, this looks old, and I couldn't get my brain around it, and I couldn't get my brain around the fact that nobody wanted this Mary Jane sketch. So I said, well, I'll take it, sir. He said, no. He goes, would you really want something like this? I said, well, from you, absolutely. And he goes, no, I'll do you a better one. You don't want to take this. So he had kind of made the promise, and I never pursued it. I never mentioned it to him again or anything, and it went away.
Mm-hmm.
But my rep, being a terrific guy and having occasion to have some contact with Mr. Romita, he brought it up. He said, you know, Rod Friends would never broach this with you, but there was this interaction you guys had, and he would love a Mary Jane and all this stuff. So John did one for me. It's beautiful.
Wow.
But he included a note that said, you know, I understand, you know, this fulfills a longstanding promise. I don't understand why you didn't just draw it yourself. You know, that kind of thing. And again, what a wonderful complimentary thing to say. I mean, it's just, it never ceases to amaze me when I'm interacting with my idols, how welcoming they are to new talent. How they, if you're there working at Marvel, they treat you like an equal, and that just blows your mind. I mean, I'm friends with Sal Buscemi, Adam. That's just nuts on the face of it, right? And there was another interaction with John in person. A dear friend of mine painted a Thor poster that I had laid out. I had designed it, and he did a beautiful job painting it. But there was some concern from the editor that he had made Thor look a little too classically Greek or Roman, you know, that kind of thing. And they wanted him to match, you know, more, it look more Nordic, to look more like Kirby's. So they sent us down to Romita's office, his art director, and John did a little tracing over the painting, and got the size of the face and everything, and he sketched a proportion, sketched a Thor head for the illustrator, Dan Horn, actually, if you know his work. And Dan took that home and made the changes in the painting, and it became a very good-selling poster. But anyway, as John was doing the sketch, he said, yeah, Kirby always did more of it. You know, he's a rounder face. He's not a square jaw. He's got a rounder Nordic face and you know, very, very strong features. He goes, well, while you're on Thor, how do you handle the character? And my brain short circuited it. It's like, you know, Fred Astaire asking you to show him some steps or something. You know, it was just, John Romita was asking my opinion about anything. And I'm sure I babbled like a fool, because I was so taken aback by the fact that he had asked. But yeah, there are those moments in your career where you are blessed with that kind of interaction and that kind of response from the people that you genuinely admire, that give you some sense that you're doing okay and that you've arrived to some degree at your goal, you know, from when you were 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a blessing that nobody deserves. I mean, he was an amazing man. I am so jealous of guys like Tom Morgan and some of the other guys who were actually Ramirez Raiders who learned at his elbow, you know. I can't even imagine what that would have been like. But I know what I was able to spend time with him at least at that one show and once or twice in the offices, as I've related. And he's a wonderful guy. You know, if he's feeling pressure, he doesn't show it. A complete professional. And it was wonderful in Chicago because I was able to be around him and Virginia without the pressure of deadlines. Because Virginia, if you ran into Virginia in the office, you were kind of avoiding her because she was the traffic manager and you probably had pages to, you know, that kind of thing. But she was a very, very sweet lady, too. I remember at one point, you know, talking about having him ink me more, and he said, well, usually if I make time to ink something, it's over JR. You know, it's over his son. He said, so I really don't have the time to ink. And I said, well, you know, John, I could be your son. And Virginia heard this exchange, and she said, no, Ron, we have enough a-holes in the family. Thank you very much. You know, that kind of thing. So it was really wonderful. They're just really warm, wonderful people. And there was another project that John was inking me on. I covered it on my Facebook page a couple times. It was a Spider-Man Create Your Own Adventure that Peter David wrote it and put a lot of work into it because it was one of those, you know, you get to page 6 and you go to, if you want Spider-Man to do this, go to page 9. If you want Spider-Man to do this, go to page 7, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he put a lot of work into it. And it was one of those work on it when you have time to work on it things. And I penciled, oh, I don't know. I didn't even pencil half of it because it was going to be like a graphic novel type thing. I think it was like 60-some pages, 64 pages or something like that. And I think I penciled about 20 pages. I think Ramita inked about half of that maybe. And the stuff I saw was just incredibly gorgeous. Apparently some of the pages are out on the art market. They, you know, languished in a drawer until Ramita sold them off. I don't know whether they even were sold by him because I never received pages back. Even the ones he didn't ink, I never received back. So I have no idea what happened to the pages. I have Xeroxes of my pencils. I have Xeroxes of the pages that he inked, and I put some of it up on Facebook a few times. Gregory Wright, who was an editor at Marvel, who was the editor of that project at one point, kind of came on and explained that it just kind of went away. It wasn't a priority, and it was never reassigned. You know, Ramita was having trouble producing pages because of his daily duties as editor, art editor, and certainly I was on Thor at the time, sometimes doing the bi-weeklies during the summer, and it just, I feel terrible that it was never completed because of all the work that Peter David did on it. But I mean, there are some beautiful pages out there. Absolutely, a few more things that were I was blessed to be inked by John Ramita. So, otherwise, my reaction to it and my feeling about it is no different than any other fan. I mean, he was Marvel, you know? I mean, you hear the stories about how he just assumed that Spider-Man was, you know, where was Spider-Man going to go without Ditko? And, you know, it was kind of thrust upon him. The same thing happened when Kirby left, and he assumed the Fantastic Four was just going to be canceled. And Dan said, no, you're going to do it. And it was thrust upon him. I mean, what an incredible craftsman, though. I mean, he always rose to the occasion. You know, the issues, the issue of Fantastic Four, the one or two issues he did to Reign by Senate were just stunningly beautiful. It would have been fantastic to see a longer run, but then they hired John Buscema, to do it. But, you know, a longer run with Romita in Senate would have been incredible. And as a fan, I just, he was one of those iconic illustrators that I held as the standard, you know, along with Sal Buscema, John Buscema, Jack Kirby, and Will Eisner. And, you know, he was, he took so much of what Kirby had to teach and added this touch of glamour that came from his time on the romance books and his time in advertising. You know, he couldn't draw an ugly person if he tried, really. And it's just amazing stuff. His draftsmanship and his storytelling were always spot on. Just amazing, amazing work. It's a great loss, but thank God he's left his body of work behind and an example to all of us screw up freelancers about, you know, how to do the job and leave us with this incredible body of work, you know.
I want to ask you a general question about inking, which we'll get into more specifically about when you did the annual 96 together, is more when you, I mean, you obviously have had a very long career, but when you have been penciling and you've had a lot of different people inking you, do you, when you see people inking you and kind of finding nuances of your work that maybe you didn't intend or didn't expect and seeing it, you know, expanded in different ways as people use their own flourish, has that impacted how you then pencil at times, especially if you're with that same inker, like issue in and issue out? Or how do you kind of interact with that? Or is it just kind of in a vacuum and you just kind of, you keep your pencils as your pencils and then they do their job as inkers? Or do you assimilate and start to make some changes and shifts to your pencils, either to accommodate the inker or just because you saw, oh, the inker did this and I can actually do that in the pencils if I keep them tight, or I can do this? Like, does that make sense as a question?
Yes. And the answer is yes. All of that. It depends. There was a case on Spider Girl where I did breakdowns on a job, not knowing who was going to ink it. Mm-hmm. And it was inked by this young inker who used a lot of pen. And I just didn't feel that we meshed all that well in that issue. Mm-hmm. A few issues later, it was when Pat was the regular penciler. So a few issues later, I was called upon to do another fill-in, and I was told that same anchor was going to ink it. So I did exactly what you suggested. I tried to adjust my finishing style so that it would work better with pen, and he would have less thinking to do than he did over the breakdown. And in fact, to the degree that I pulled out the illustrator Joe Madureira, who worked on X-Men for a while and has done all kinds of books. He was a huge fan favorite for a while.
Yes, he was.
And I pulled out a bunch of his X-Men stuff and was looking at that because that was the kind of technique that this young inker was using. So I did an entire issue of Spider-Girl with, you know, kind of cribbing from Joe Madureira. And it worked much better. He inked it, and it meshed a hell of a lot better, and it looked a hell of a lot more like we were all on the same page, to use a term. Mm-hmm. And I was much happier with it than the initial job. So, yes, you can. That is something that you do when you have enough lead time and enough behind-the-scenes knowledge to know where it's going to go. Working with Sal Buscema was very hand in glove. I learned so much about the language, the shorthand of comics, that it was very, very hand in glove. If I ever looked at Sal's inks and I'd go, oh, that eye's a little crooked, he kind of lost that expression, I would go and look at my pencils and go, no, he didn't, that's exactly what I penciled. I'm the one who made the eye crooked, you know, that kind of thing. So, and it was amazing. All the, for all the years that Sal and I worked together, it's just incredible. I knew that whatever I was putting down on the page was going to make it to the reader, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a fantastic feeling. Brett enhances, you know, Brett brings his own point of view to the pencils, his own knowledge of anatomy. He'll do some correcting, he'll do some adjusting, and has his own approach, and the final product is a hybrid. It's a combination of my approach and his approach, which usually looks, you know, it's more than the sum of its parts, which is great. I'm trying to think of any other examples of that kind of thing. Working with Ramita, when you're drawing Ramita and you're inking characters that you've been associated with for years, we're talking 30, 40 years, okay? They cannot help but draw with the brush or the pen and adjust. Another example would be Pat Olive did a Dacula miniseries. It was written by Glenn Greenberg, and it was to be inked by Tom Palmer. Now, Pat pulled out his Tomb of Dracula stuff, and he wanted it to, you know, be the same Dracula that Gene Colan had drawn. So he used his reference, and he did Dracula. And Tom Palmer just drew his own Dracula. In much the same way that when I worked with him on Star Wars, he was the look of Star Wars. I was coming in, you know, he had worked with Walt Simonson for years over Walt's layouts, and he was the look of Star Wars. So when I came in, it was very clear that my purview was to tell the story and do layouts, and Tom was the finisher. But, you know, being one of my first regular assignments, I had photo reference of all the lead characters and would attempt my own likenesses and all this. But Tom already had a template in his head for how he handled Luke and how he handled Han and how he handled Lando and Princess Leia. And it didn't really matter what I was putting down because he was the finisher and he was drawing with the brush and the pen. So a lot of these gentlemen who are, you know, veterans at this, they do it without even noticing it. I mean, at one point, Pat mentioned it in conversation, not as a criticism, but he mentioned it in conversation with Mr. Palmer, and his response was, really? I'm doing that? Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh. So they don't realize it. You know, they just don't. So, you know, there are those moments where, you know, you feel like if they haven't changed it too much, you must have done something right because they agree with it, you know, that kind of thing. Sal agreed with a lot of things because, again, I learned my shorthand from him. But, you know, Mr. Ramita, a few things less, you know, but it was nothing that in any way offended me, because if you get adjusted by John Ramita, you say, thank you, may I have another? I mean, you pack that away as a lesson, and you use it for the next time, you know? The only thing that was interesting, and it's happened to me with Sal as well, is in that Spider-Man 96, we were flashing back to the Ramita era. Mm-hmm. And we were doing a story that happened between specific issues with Kraven the Hunter. So I deliberately did not put a lot of shadow on Spider-Man's costume because John wasn't doing that at the time. And I made the eyepieces a little smaller the way they were being drawn at that time. Mm-hmm. Because in my opinion, you know, when I look at it, I just kind of allow for the way it was drawn in different eras is actually an indication of different suits that Pete has sewn over the years when they get torn up and everything, right? Mm-hmm. So in my brain, in my fanboy brain, he had a suit with smaller eyepieces back then. So let's let's match that, you know. So that's what I did. I didn't have a conversation with Mr. Romita about that, so he fixed the eyepieces and made them look more contemporary, and he drew more blacks on the blue area as it was being done at that time.
Hmm.
And, you know, when I saw it, it's not like I was going to call up John Romita and say, how dare you? I mean, it looked great. But, you know, when I pointed it out in a Facebook essay, Glenn Greenberg, who was the editor of that project, said, you know, he never caught that, but he would have felt the same way. You don't go correcting John Romita about Spider-Man, you know, that kind of thing. And the same thing has happened when I've tried to do a flashback with Sal of Ditko Spider-Man, where, you know, I draw the reverse webbing or something like that to try to match what was being done at the time by Mr. Ditko, and Sal will always fix it, because Sal draws Spider-Man's webbing the same way every time, God love him. So what are you going to do? You know, I mean, that's, you know, you pay your money, you take your chances. It would have been nice if he would have called and said, you know, you drew this wrong, and I went, no, Sal, actually, I deliberately did it that way because that's very Ditko. But he didn't even ask. He just fixed it.
Yeah.
He might be sitting there going, wow, what's Ron smoking? I don't know. But he was regularly fixing stuff like that. And, you know, and I use fixing in quotes because, like I said, it was deliberate. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's a very, very minor thing that the reader never suffers for or notices or cares.
Mm-hmm. So a question about that Amazing Spider-Man 96 annual. So, because you bring up the question, you bring up the point that, you know, it's a really good flashback tale because you are going back to kind of the Romita era. This might be a stupid question. Was the decision to make it a Romita era story made before John Romita had, you know, signed on to be the inker?
Yeah, Tom and I have a hard time remembering whether or not we knew Romita was going to ink it at the time I penciled it. I'm really not sure.
Hmm.
But no, that had nothing to do with it. The decision to make it Romita era was, we started the conversation with Tom saying, so what classic Spider-Man villain did we not get around to? Because when we came on the book, we didn't do any Spider-Man classic villains. Tom's agenda as we came on the book was to create new characters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so none of the classics. Only when we did that two-part Web Spinners,
mm-hmm.
He said, who would you like to do? I said, Doc Ock. And when we did the annual, it was, is there anybody you'd like to, anybody in particular you'd like to do? And before he finished the question, I went, Kraven! I want to do Kraven! So it was about finding a story, you know, a Kraven story that worked. And we kind of, I was fast. I was a big fan of the book, of course, at that period. And I loved the idea of delineating that shade of a moment when Captain Stacy figured it out.
Hmm.
Because it was never established how long he knew or anything like that when he finally admits to Peter that he did know, that he figured it out. And I always loved the question of whether or not Joe Robertson knew.
Hmm.
And because they were working on it together. They were trying to figure it out together. There were a lot of scenes shown during the Romita period, during the Buscema-Romita-Mooney period, where there were a lot of scenes of Joe and Captain Stacy meeting and discussing it and trying to figure it out. And Pete was very threatened by it. And so we didn't want to, you know, we wanted to pick a time, a moment when it was separate from Joe Robertson. Because we didn't want to speak to whether or not Joe knows.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so what we did was we came up with that little moment where Pete inadvertently is in a situation where he says the same thing as Pete and then says the same thing as Spider-Man, and we see the moment of recognition where Cap Stacy figures it out. And the fact that it's Pete, I'm not assuming he wouldn't run and tell Joe, because it's personal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. Personally, I think there have been plenty of scenes done where there's a part of me that thinks Joe Robertson does know, but I'm not even sure he's a part of the book anymore. It's been years since I've read that Spider-Man that showed Joe Robertson at all. But, you know, there were plenty of scenes done even by Jerry Conway that always left me with the feeling that Joe had figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that came mostly, that wasn't because we knew Romita was going to be involved. It was because I wanted to draw Kraven.
Now, in the framing sequence to that annual, so you're actually drawing Ben Reilly as Spider-Man, and I think I've mentioned this or asked this before, but I mean, I guess that would have been, I believe, your first kind of time drawing that iteration of the costume, correct?
Indeed it was, yes.
And obviously that stuck for you, because it was obviously something you would bring back as Spider-Girls, and it actually looks better on her. But like, when you first drew it, like, did you know that, like, how did you feel about that costume? Because obviously it's a diversion from the traditional Spider-Man costume. You obviously had been around when the black costume came out, so you knew what fandom can be like when Spider-Man's costume changes. How did you feel about drawing it at that time?
I loved Ben Reilly's costume. I thought it was a really well-designed advancement of the original suit. I am second to none in my admiration for the original suit. I think the design of that costume is pure and simple genius. I love it from every angle. I think it's incredible. I like it best, in all deference to Mr. Romita, I like it best when Ditko draws it, because there are certain characteristics to that suit that only he got right. And, you know, so I always return to his approach on it. Having said that, I thought the Ben Reilly suit was really, really nice. The final design they came up with was really cool. And I enjoyed drawing it in that annual. And curiously enough, when it came time to do Spider-Girl, and in Tom's original plot, she was just wearing the classic suit, it was my idea to use the Ben Reilly outfit, partly because I had handled it before, but also because I, too, thought that's going to work really well on the female figure. And interestingly enough, when Sal joined us on the regular run of the book, he felt from the very beginning that there was something very feminine about that costume. And I think it was the way the legs break up the torso, because they're perfect for framing the breasts, and I think that's probably what he was seeing even on the male figure. It really did work incredibly well on the female figure, and in many ways better, you know, with the V waist, the whole bit, you know, I mean, so it just all seemed to come together, and Tom had no problem with me using it for Spider-Girl, and so we done stole it.
Repurposed.
There you go. There's a word.
So I have a question actually about that What If 105. When you do have Sal doing his inks, and I would say that was probably, so not Sal, it was Sienkiewicz doing the inks, right?
Sienkiewicz did the inks on that, yeah.
So how do you feel about how that book kind of works, because it's a very different interpretation of your traditional style because it's Bill doing the inks. I mean, I would say you put it up against any of your other art and it is decidedly different because of, he was definitely in a heavier ink period, because he did that a lot on Sal, I believe, as well, when Sal was working on Spectacular Spider-Man. He had a very heavy ink line that very much transformed what Sal's traditionally, not cumbersome artwork, like he's got a very simple, elegant line, and suddenly, you know, Bill was adding a lot of extra depth to it, and a lot more of him was being, you know, brought out in that art. So how do you feel about how his interpretation of your art works in What If 105? Because it's obviously one of your most reprinted issues, probably, because it's, you know, the first appearance of Spider-Girl.
Yeah, probably at this point. I put Sienkiewicz in the same realm as John Romita and Sal Buscema and Kevin Nolan and Tom Palmer and a lot of these people who are very powerful inkers and you know, it usually just looks good. So just take the credit for it if you can. What's interesting is that What If 105 was inked by Sienkiewicz, and so was What If, I believe it was like 107, where we did a Thor Thunderstrike thing. It was basically What If Tom and Ron had not left Thor, and they were night and day. He used a lot of brush on Spider-Girl. It was very loose and kinetic, and then on the Thor job, he used a lot of pen, and it was much more controlled, much more delicate in places, and it was fascinating. I've never had the opportunity to have a conversation with Bill about why he made those choices or anything, but it was wonderful. Both were wonderful. I actually preferred what he did over the Thor job as Inks, but the Spider-Girl job was, you know, he didn't lose any of the storytelling, he didn't lose any of the expressions, and, you know, you hope for a job that when it's finally printed, just makes you not shudder or be embarrassed or take your name off it or anything. I've had one or two of those. And so I'm really happy with what we ended up with. And as far as total content, I'd like to think if there ever was a Ron Friends omnibus or, you know, my personal favorite stories or something, What If 105 will be one of them, because I think beginning, middle, and end, I think Tom and I put together a really nifty little story there. I think it has a lot of guts, and the characters were given a lot of backstory and legs to, even though we weren't in any way thinking about doing a series when we did it. It was just a lot of fun, you know, reinterpreting those characters, 16 years later, and letting the characters age a little bit and everything. I think we did a lot right in that one story. So it's one of the ones I'm still very, very fond of, very proud of. And, I would probably choose to include it if there were a collection like that done. Mm-hmm. But, I have no problems at all with what the final pencils were. So the final looks of the book, I guess I'd say.
Mm-hmm. It is, I mean, part of what I think people, why that book resonated, besides obviously the character being a really cool idea, and seeing Peeta as a parent and seeing what that meant, especially because it felt like at the time we didn't get that in the main universe, so this was a way of getting that. But it also felt like you and Tom breathed a lot of life into what could have just been a done in one, right? But where it always, and the fact that you went to such painstaking lengths to sketch out what would these future Avengers even look like. They're in there for a panel, and yet you imbued it with life enough that, you know, people look at it and it's like, well, I want to know more about that team. And so, like, there was a feeling of the world feeling lived in that definitely led it, obviously, to become, you know, the cornerstone of what became the MC2, because you guys gave it such a great foundation.
That's exactly how that happened, kind of by accident, is when Bob Harris, who's editor-in-chief at the time, when he saw all the prep work I had done just for the one shot, he assumed it was a pitch for a series. And Tom said, no, that's just the kind of work Ron puts into one story, you know, because we had to design Normie and his tattoos, and I had to decide what older Pete looks like and what older Mary Jane looks like. You know, I was trying to combine elements of Pete and Mary Jane into Mayday, and of course she ended up looking, as I said in my notes, she looks a lot like Stellaris, so sue me, at least I'm consistent. But because I think short hair looks terrific on women, and there was a friend of mine that was kind of the basis for those characters. But Tom's agenda when he was the regular writer for as brief a time as he was on What If, and he was coming up with ideas, was to not fall into the everything goes dark, everybody dies, What If thing. It was too easy. It was always like moving chess pieces and action figures and just, you know, and doing Spider-Man, you know, we decided early on that, you know, this is a neat little opportunity, a little microcosm opportunity where let's pretend that the book was canceled when we left back in the 80s and doing a revival for streaming, you know, that kind of thing. And we got the actors back together and we got the gang back together. And what's been going on with them? You know, that kind of thing. So there was, you know, we love those characters. So we were able to imbue that with a little more heart than some stories in What If were known for. And I do think that that carried some weight. And then again, there was the, you know, the fact that I had done all the prep work made people think it was a pitch. So, you know, who's complaining? We got some wonderful, wonderful stories out of it. You know, those first several years with Tom and Pat were just unsurpassed. Some wonderful, wonderful storytelling.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting that you bring up the idea that, you know, a lot of, especially in that time period, a lot of What If books were almost comically, like everything went bad afterwards, this one thing, and then the whole universe gets destroyed, almost to a comical effect. And your guys' interpretation was obviously very different. And also, it had a happy ending. Like, it had, first of all, you know, it was more optimistic than, I guess, the typical What Ifs would have been, which makes sense why then people would have latched onto it as a, I want to see more of this.
Yeah, well, we thought, you know, maybe there'd be a sequel down the road, but we really didn't give it much thought. We had moved on to, you know, the next one we did together was, you know, basically how we would have pursued Thor had we stayed on the book. You know, that kind of thing. Let him become King of Asgard and Eric staying on Earth. And it, you know, so we were able to, you know, we moved on to another set of toys. And really didn't give it much thought. I mean, until we were contacted by Marvel, and they were interested in not only Spider-Girl, but two other titles to put in the bags for mass market, for like, you know, Walmarts and Sam's Clubs and things like that. They wanted something with no ties to the regular continuity, no continuity heavy stuff, and something that would appeal to all ages. So, you know, when Tom met with Bob Harris and the editorial team, you know, it was like, well, what do you see as the other titles? And he goes, well, the Spider-Girl, I mean, what about this A-Nex? This Avengers team could work. The Fantastic Five could work. I like this Junior Juggernaut. And Tom went, what Junior Juggernaut? And he goes, right here, there's one panel. And that's when he called me and said, did you know that was Juggernaut Jr.? I said, no, that was just A. Marco. And he goes, yeah, well, he's not anymore. So, yeah, it was, you know, it was a crazy time. It was, you know, it was a very neat time because, I mean, that was a wonderful sandbox to play in because we had our own little corner of the Marvel Universe where we weren't overlapping, we weren't involved in the crossovers and all that, and we could, you know, make our own little statement about these characters. And yeah, it was one of the very, very, very few positive futures. I mean, you know, it was at the same time that, what was the series that Alex Ross worked on? I'm sorry.
Earth X.
You know, that was very dark and almost to a character. And again, most What Ifs were dark. So yeah, we were definitely more Star Trek, the original series kind of guys where, you know, we had a world full of superheroes. How the hell are the wheels always coming off the cart? So, you know, in our minds, the first, that generation of superheroes actually did what they set out to do and make the world a better place to the degree that when the next generation of young kids comes along that find themselves with superpowers or the ability to help, that they're inspired by that generation and to do the same thing. Not everybody. Some of them became bad guys, but, you know, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm. So I have a question before I let you go for the evening. So we've talked before about how when you first got a chance to draw Spider-Man, especially in the Kid Who Collects. You were definitely channeling more of a Ditko-inspired approach. And then as you were on the main title, that kind of evolved to be more of like a Romita approach to the characters. I'm curious about in the mid-90s when you did two issues of Untold Tales of Spider-Man, which is clearly set in the Ditko period, so you get to channel those Ditko influences, and then you get to also do a very, you know, early Ditko version of the Lizard. I'm just curious, first of all, like how those two issues kind of came about and what it was like to be able to kind of, you know, just dive into the Silver Age characters and renditions and really get to play in that sandbox, because you're dealing with versions of the characters that are prior to the Romita Revolution.
Right. No, it was terrific. I mean, that came about because I shared studio space with Pat Olive,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't getting any regular work at the time. For a long period of time, I was doing like Catch as Catch Can freelance. I was subcontracting through a couple of other guys and doing some very odd jobs and things. I wasn't doing anything regular for comics. So when Pat needed a fill in or wanted a fill in. He never really needed them. Occasionally, they would always be scheduled. But you know, he was able to tell them that I was available, and they were very kind to give me the work. So it was terrific. I didn't really go whole hog Ditko. I always used Ditko detail on the costume, but I didn't go whole hog Ditko in the storytelling because Pat had come such a long way in, you know, bringing that vibe into the modern aesthetic. So I didn't want to, you know, roll back the clock or anything and try to make it look like a Ditko book. But you're right, we were doing, you know, Pete with the flat top and the glasses and all that kind of stuff. So it was a lot of fun. I mean, I loved that Lizard issue. The Goblin issue, I just did lighter breakdowns on.
Mm.
That final issue, though, that happened a little bit more on the fly, I think, and I contributed a little less to that. That was mostly McLeod on finishes there, and he's another one of those. Also being a penciler, he tends to bring a lot of himself to the final product, which works just great when you're doing lighter breakdowns.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that Lizard issue was a lot of fun. For me, the Lizard is an interesting character for me because I looked at the early Ditko and the Spider-Man 67 cartoon did this incredible simplified version of what Ditko really had on the page. And I really didn't realize that at first. I loved what they did with the Lizard on that cartoon. Ever since I was a kid, and I loved that look for the Lizard more than the longer snout and everything. But then when I became a real Ditko devotee, when I was on Spider-Man, I would look at those old issues and realize that, oh my God, what those animators were doing was this wonderfully simplified Ditko version of the Lizard. And it all kind of clicked, and that's how I always draw the Lizard now. I don't do the longer snout that Romita brought to it, it's just the way I love drawing the Lizard. I think it's much more expressive. I think it just really works really, really well. And I've actually had opportunity to do two other covers for Ditko reprints of the original Lizard story. One was for a newspaper supplement, and one was for when Marvel Tales went back to the beginning.
Oh, okay.
I think it was called Spider-Man Classic or something at one point. And they started from number one. And I did a few covers for that, and one of them was the Lizard. And I'd love any opportunity to do the Lizard. I draw the Lizard that way anyway, but certainly when it's going to be connected or covering the original Ditko story, then I feel like I'm completely allowed to indulge that earlier version of the Lizard. So, that is what I brought to that story. And Brett Breeding ate that job. And
I thought it was Al Vey.
I'm happy with that. No. The lizard one that we did was inked by Brett.
Oh.
Yeah, Al was the regular inker, but in most cases, when you do a fill-in, you're also going to get a fill-in inker, so both the penciler and the inker can move on to the next issue. In fact, I'm not even sure Al was still the regular inker at that point. I don't know where it fell in the run, because Al Williamson came in there at some point and became the regular inker on the book. I don't know whether he had at that point or not. And the final issue we did was, I guess Pat had moved on to whatever his next assignment was going to be. And there was some very loose talk, because Roger Stern scripted it, and there was some very loose talk about continuing the book with Roger and I, which I would have welcomed at the time, because as I said, I wasn't doing regular comics work. But it was not to be, for one reason or the other. But that would have been a lot of fun, working with Roger on a regular basis.
Oh, for sure. So I was going to let you go, and I realized I had one other question for you.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm curious about what it was like for you and Tom working on Hulk Smash Avengers. Because there was, I guess, one issue, and it was, again, very early days of the Avengers, so you get to do, again, one of these kind of throwback tales, and you get to channel a little bit more Kirby, and you have some, you know, Enchantresses in there, and I know you guys, like, again, love playing with the Asgardians, so you have Enchantress, and you have Scourge, the Executioner. I'm just curious what it was like working on that particular book, and how much of it was breakdowns versus, you know, more complete pencils.
No, I did pretty tight pencils on that. I got to the point with Sal where I said I was so gratified that what I was knowing that what I was putting on the page was going to make it to the reader that, you know, I might have left some blanks to be filled in and stuff. But for the most part, I was doing really tight breakdowns. And I indulged my love of early Buscema. I indulged my love of Kirby. I indulged myself completely on that job, especially the era of the Hulk in that, because way back to when Tom DeFalco and I first met in person, one of the things that we bonded over was our love of the Hulk when he was less childlike. It was one of Tom's favorite eras where he was a little more cunning, a little more there. It's more, you know, and they hadn't got to the completely to the Hulk Smash yet, and it was like those early times when he fought the Fantastic Four and his early interactions with the Avengers. He was actually a hard-nosed, cunning character that was really felt more dangerous even than the childlike Hulk. And it was a lot of fun to play with that. What was interesting is a lot of the reviews I read. The people reviewing it were like, I don't know where the Hulk ever had a phase like that. It's like, where's all this coming from? Well, it's era specific. It's era accurate, that kind of thing. But I love doing the classic. I love doing classic Cap. I love doing the classic Iron Man armor with the studs on the mask. Oh my God, that was a lot of fun. And, of course we plotted something where we could just have a nice knockdown, drag out slobber knocker. I mean, the thing with Hulk Smash, it actually started out where there was some talk about Tom and I doing the entire series. And Tom kind of did an arc. He kind of spitballed the arc and what eras and all that kind of stuff. And I believe, if I remember the series as it played out, they kind of stuck to what Tom had pitched as each of the eras that were there. But again, it just was one of those things that, early conversations kind of morphed and it turned into what it turned into. I would have loved to have done Roger Stern's issue that was kind of an homage to John Buscema and somebody else, and I forget who the other homage was, I'm sorry to say, but there was some really nice stuff. stories that were done. I remember feeling like the second one was just kind of a rehash of what we had done. And that could have been avoided, you know, if editorial would have. I think we were working on them concurrently. And so I think that's kind of how that happened. And, you know, in monthly publishing, things like that happen every once in a while. But yeah, it was great fun. Oh, I enjoyed that issue immensely.
So I thought that was my last one. I have one more.
Okay.
Just an excuse to talk to Ron for longer, right?
It is not an effort, believe me, sir.
Okay. My last question is, actually, I have an upcoming guest from the show who hasn't been on the show before, is Mike Carlin. And I guess you guys worked together on the Superman books because he was the Superman editor at the time, correct?
Not really.
Oh, no. Had you already moved on by then?
He was gone by then, yeah.
Oh.
The two editors I worked with were Casey Carlson and Jody Cavalieri.
Okay.
So Mike was not the line editor by the time I got there. But I worked with Mike on the two annuals that I did after Byrne took over. And I find him an incredibly talented and professional editor. He's an incredible guy. The fact that he wrote Herd on those creatives for as long as he did and produced the kind of work that they did together, I will always have great respect for what they were able to accomplish. Because the 2 years or so that I was on Superman, that was a tough gig. Anybody that did it for any period of time, God love them. Because working where you're basically doing, you know, 1 week of a weekly book, where you have to hit the ground running. The plot shows up, you have to do layouts immediately. You cannot sit with that plot for a day or two because you need to get the layouts going because the next guy needs to see it. And it really was an amazing, a high pressure way of doing comics. You know, I feel like I did some decent work on it, but I didn't feel like I was doing my best work on it because of the turnaround time. I mean, Joe Rubenstein made that stuff look amazing, and Glenn Whitmore's colors kind of tied it all together. But I was able to get some fun once we kind of got into the flow. I was able to have some fun with the characters and. Especially Clark Kent. I enjoyed drawing Clark, and I enjoyed drawing Superman. I had some time. Once I caught my breath early on, I had some time to, you know, find my equilibrium and really enjoy the characters. And I'm just very proud to have, in any way, worked on Superman. I mean, that's just something that's terrific to have on your CV, you know, that kind of thing.
Like, how many people can say they had runs on both Superman and Spider-Man?
If you could say both, that's even better. But
that's what I mean. Like, how many have done both? I mean, I guess John Romita Jr. is one of the few.
Well, John Romita Jr., Dan Jurgens worked on Spider-Man
for
a while.
That's true.
You know, at one point, when they did the first Superman-Spider-Man team-up, only Ross Andrew really was qualified because he had worked on Superman in World's Finest, in Action, and Lois Lane, all that kind of stuff. So he would have been one of the few that would have worked on both Spider-Man and Superman. But I think it's a little more commonplace now because, you know, freelancers move between companies a lot more than they used to back in the day. But,
true.
Yeah, Dan Jurgens would definitely be on that list because, he came over and did... he worked on Spider-Man during the Ben Reilly stuff.
That's right, yeah. No,
sure, I'm sure if they were to do another Superman Spider-Man, Dan would probably be at the top of the list of people they would contact to do it.
For sure. Now, if they did any kind of like 30th anniversary of the Electric costume, would you do a story?
I don't know. I mean, from what I've heard with the 30th anniversary of the death and the 30th anniversary of the return, Dan Jurgens has had to do some standing his ground to get the old guys back on it. DC had floated the idea, editorial had floated the idea of bringing in the, you know, new guys to celebrate the 30th anniversary. And he goes, how does that work? You know, so he had to kind of fight to get the old band back together. So if they were to do any kind of 30th anniversary with that, I don't know whether I'd even be contacted, to tell you the God's honest truth. And there was something going around for a while. I don't know if it hasn't happened yet or how it played out or whatever, but there was some stuff that was being done with Superman's son, but there was like a cover where he looked like he was going to use the Electric Blue outfit or something like that.
That's right, yeah.
Did you see any of that stuff?
Yeah, actually, now that you mention it, I do remember seeing it, and they were definitely using the symbol. I don't know if anything more came of it, but I'm behind in reading those issues, so I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't get out to a comic shop near as often as I would like. And, so, yeah, I'm not sure how that played out or if it's going to play out or how it's going to play out. But, you know, it always amazed me how many different action figures there were of that look, given, you know, that most people look back on it with a certain amount of disdain. I meet people all the time, the same way I meet people who are diehard Thunderstrike fans and, you know, diehard Spider-Girl fans. I meet people who loved the Electric Blue. You know, I started reading Superman because I didn't think something like that could happen, and it was just really amazing to fun to see. It was like it got to be our Superman, and I'm like, wow, okay, that kind of thing. So,
yeah,
but everything is somebody's favorite, you know.
I mean, as we've discussed many times, A-Next is one of mine, so I get it.
There you go. It really is one of those things that, you know, you'll see people on Facebook all the time that will make the broad statement of, you know, everybody's embarrassed by Electric Blue Superman, and nobody wants to admit that happened. I hear that same thing about Eric Masterson and all that, and it's like, we'll agree to disagree on that one, because I travel the country at conventions, and I meet people all the time that are huge fans of those concepts, you know, so never assume that the way you feel about it is the way everybody feels about it. That seems to be the refuge of small minds to me sometimes.
Hmm. Absolutely. Well, you know, Ron, again, thank you so much for, it's funny, I don't even know why I bother sometimes when I say to you before we record, oh, we're going to go 30 minutes to 45 minutes, and it always goes an hour 15, so I should just stop, you know, stop pretending it's going to be short, because I enjoy talking to you too much.
Well, it is not an effort, Adam. I enjoy speaking with you. I always have. I love your questions. I love your insights. You know, sometimes you give me credit for things that I wasn't even thinking at the time, but you have given me a different point of view about work I've done, and it's always been enlightening and a lot of fun. And I thank you for that, and I'm glad you're back doing some of these interviews and everything. I look forward to listening to more of them.
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you so much, and I'll let you get back to your evening, but thanks again for joining the Comic Shenanigans podcast.
Well, you're more than welcome. It's my pleasure to be on a Comic Shenanigans podcast. And as I said before, welcome back, man.